Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. George Carlin is one of the greatest stand-up comedians of all time. Unfortunately, George was not only a very funny comedian, he was also very prophetic. That's unfortunate because George made jokes about timely subjects like the environment, big pharma, and police brutality in the 1970s. Michael Bonfiglio is the co-director, along with Judd Apatow, of the HBO Max documentary George Carlin's American Dream. It's a very detailed look inside the mind of Carlin and the ups and downs he faced during his career. Michael joined us to talk about the timeless genius of George Carlin and how he became one of comedy's titans.
As a kid, George was really drawn to very mainstream comedy and entertainment. When he was a child, he looked up to people like Danny Kaye and Bob Hope, but especially Danny Kaye, he always cited as one of his heroes. And so he had this dream very early on as a kid. He really wanted to be a comedic movie star, not a stand-up comic. He sort of saw comedy as a way to that ultimate goal of being a movie star. But clearly it didn't quite work out that way, and I think we're all fortunate that it didn't.
You have some great material from George's older brother, Patrick. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, unfortunately, Patrick just passed away about 4 weeks ago. Yeah, we were very fortunate, though, to have him participate in the film and interview him at his home in the Catskills. And Patrick, I think, was, you know, he was older than George by 5 years. He was somebody that George looked up to, and I think he served as a bit of a muse for George.
And he sent me a little manila folder, just a small one, a little bigger than a Christmas card. And he wrote on it in a marker, "For those days when everything has got you down, and when you open it up, there was a photo of my father's gravestone." Isn't that beautiful?
You know, Patrick was not in entertainment. He was a sort of a true New Yorker. The two of them were very close. They really loved each other. And George looked up to Patrick, but also took care of him, you know, financially and in other ways. So it was a very close relationship.
When did George pivot from family-friendly suit and tie comedy to becoming the voice of the counterculture generation?
Well, it was a slow transformation. And I personally find that period of his career so fascinating because when he first starts out with his partner, Jack Burns, they're a comedy team, Burns and Carlin, and they're kind of, you know, it's 1960, and this is a time that comedy is changing and moving away from the sort of post-vaudevillian kind of comedy to more edgy stuff. People like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, The Second City, Compass Players, Nichols and May, what the media termed as sick comics, people like Jonathan Winters as well. Burns and Carlin were finding their way, and a lot of their material is kind of edgy. And George was going back and forth after Burns and Carlin broke up between, he was trying to find his way.
In 1961, John Kennedy brought humor back to the White House, along with a lot of football equipment and a bunch of relatives. Thank you very much. On behalf of the Attorney General, to Joint Chiefs of Staff, to members of the Supreme Court, and the rest of my family.
And so always underneath the surface, even in his sort of clean-cut days, there's always this other version of George, the real George, that's bubbling under the surface. So he's struggling all throughout the 60s until he finally, around 1969, 1970, fully transforms into the sort of hippie, long-haired George that became so successful in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. George's first attempt at changing his comedy happened here in Wisconsin at Lake Geneva. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the first time, but it was one of the first and certainly one of the most notable because he was essentially run out of town. Bette Midler, interestingly enough, happened to be opening for him that night. And it was at the Playboy Club in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And George was playing to a very, what he would call a very square audience. And he began to talk about consumerism and the Vietnam War, and he was basically run off the stage. People were threatening to beat him up, and Playboy at the time and since has this reputation for being very, pro free speech and anti-censorship and things like that. And the Playboy Club and Hugh Hefner and Playboy did not back George at all and kind of left him out to dry. And so he was fired from that. And it was a seminal moment for him because he realized that the people that he was performing for were not the people that he related to. And he didn't want to relate to those people. So those confrontations helped fuel his decision to change his persona, change his act, and sort of de-transform into who he really felt mm-hmm. was comfortable being as an artist.
Yeah, his true authentic self, so to speak. Yeah, George was a self-described word freak, and he called words his babies. What can you say about his ability to play with words and how he built his comedic voice around that skill?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he saw words. I mean, he was always fascinated by words, and that's one of the things that he's most well known for is his incredible verbal mastery. You know, I think he saw a lot of hypocrisy in language. Double meanings of things, certain things being okay to say, but if it's literally the same word, just in a different order, it has a different meaning or is therefore something that is not acceptable to say. He really deconstructed language a funny and unique way.
Just take a simple thing like the word alter. Mm-hmm. Alter and change are supposed to mean the same thing. You can alter your plans, you can change your plans, and you've done the same thing. But if you alter your pants and you change your pants.
I just wanted to share a few words with you that amuse me, and combinations of words like occasional irregularity. What other kind can there be? If it were frequent, it would be regularity.
Personally, I feel like it also had something to do with his desire to show that he was intelligent. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade, and I think that he did have a bit of insecurity about that, about his lack of formal education, despite being an absolutely brilliant intellect and extremely well-read and self-educated. Some of his fascination with words perhaps came out of that. I'm not sure. It's just my own personal theory.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Of course, speaking of words, there's probably his most famous bit about the seven filthy words you can't say on broadcast. And again, we here in the Dairy State, Milwaukee this time around, played a role in Carlin's arrest. Can you tell us more about this whole incident?
Yeah, it was 1972 Summerfest in Milwaukee, and George was performing a concert. As part of his show, he performed his routine called The Seven Words You Can't Say on Television. And there were police present who objected, and they arrested him. And he was, spent a night in jail, brought into court. And oddly enough, a young assistant DA happened to be at the Summerfest. And what George was arrested for was not an obscenity charge. It was disorderly conduct, profanity.
The next day, the district attorney asked the policeman, and he was questioning me. He says, well, was there disorder? Was he saying this to people? Was he mad? Was he disorderly? Were the people disorderly? And he turned to his assistant district attorney, and he said, well, you were there. What did the audience do? He said, well, they gave him a standing ovation.
I do recall that at some point during the trial, the judge sort of covered his face. He did not want people to see that he was laughing at the routine that was being performed. There was no dispute that he said the words. The issue was, did it tend to cause or provoke a disturbance? And of course, not only did it not, I was there and saw that it did not. So George Carlin was not guilty.
Oddly, the assistant DA served as a witness for George, demonstrating that, and explained to the judge in court that there was no disturbance caused by these words. And so he was let go.
Yeah. Yeah. George did go through a period where he wasn't the counterculture king anymore. He was the butt of jokes from SCTV and Cheech Marin. And Marin even said that George Carlin is obsolete. How did George handle this?
He took it very hard. I think the SCTV parody, which is hilarious, really bothered him.
red wine, and there's white wine, but there's no green wine.
There's green grapes,
but no green wine.
For God's sakes, will you just shut up?
SCTV was the smartest, funniest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And these really bright people were seeing the, I guess at that time, tiredness of what George was doing on stage. And he wasn't cutting edge anymore. And he really hated being the butt of jokes. And he really did not like not being the guy who was being celebrated anymore. And I think that that drove his next creative phase. It's not possible for any artist to be on top all the time, you know, and we often talked about him as sort of, you know, like a musician. Even your favorite band, you don't love every single album. And so he was an artist who was constantly trying to push himself and, you know, get better. And there's going to be ups and downs. And I think one of the things that's admirable about George is that he just worked his way through those fallower creative periods and pushed himself to continue to find new things to say and new ways to say them.
Yeah. Your documentary is filled with so many of Carlin's personal letters, diaries, notes, and recordings. You use these with so much emotional power in the film. What was it like to see and or hear these for the first time?
It was really incredible. I mean, George was he was a hoarder, which is a great thing for a subject of a documentary. You know, oftentimes when you're working on something where the person is no longer here to speak for themselves, you know, they haven't left behind quite so much as George did. And so seeing these letters from the early 60s when he and Brenda are on the road and struggling, you know, it's like on his brand new letterhead that he's just had printed up that says, you know, his mother's home address with his name and a logo that were a motto that it said a cross section of modern comedy, George Carlin. It humanized him for us. You know, I never met George. Judd met him once, or excuse me, he interviewed him once and met him a couple of times very, very briefly. I never met him. So, you know, when you're listening to these recordings and seeing his handwriting and his notes to himself and some of these things that felt quite private, it's a connection to the person that's pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. So much of George's work is still cited in our pop culture today. Do you feel that he was just that prescient, or are we as a country that slow to adapt?
I think the fact that so much of what he talked about is still relevant is really disappointing. You know, I mean, when you see him talking about the environment or big pharma or police brutality, you know, in the early 70s, and things really haven't changed at all. And that was one of the things that really drew Judd and I to the project was, here's a comic who, you know, comedy as an art form is generally kind of ephemeral. It's often of its moment, and you don't usually go back decades to find wisdom in comedy. And with George, that's just not the case.
What would you do if you were the planet trying to defend against this pesky, troublesome species? Let's see, what might, viruses. Viruses might be good. They seem vulnerable to viruses. And viruses are tricky, always mutating and forming new strains whenever a vaccine is developed.
The thing that is so key with George is he's not afraid of silence. And so I think when your comedian has a specific agenda, especially one that is so explicitly political and so explicitly like, I'm going to confront the things that you think you don't want me to confront, you have to be able to keep your back stiff. Because if the audience sees you back off, then they got you.
They're all in favor of the unborn. They will do anything for the unborn. But once you're born, you're on your own.
He was talking about issues that are very much still with us, that are fundamental to our culture, to our society, to our humanity. And unfortunately, a lot of it is still extremely relevant.
How do you think George would react to our contemporary times?
Oh, you know, I think he would react very similarly to how he reacted to the times that he lived in. You know, I think he would be appalled and disappointed, you know, by our lack of caring for one another, by our greed, our hypocrisy, our the way that our society is structured to benefit the wealthy and hurt the poor. I think we have our answers as to how he would feel based on the things that he said during his lifetime, because things haven't really changed for the better by and large.
Most definitely. Very well said. Michael Bonfiglio, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on George Carlin's American Dream. It's a very entertaining and very enlightening documentary.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Bonfiglio is the co-director, along with Judd Apatow, of the HBO Max documentary, George Carlin's American Dream. You can find out more about George at WPR.org/beta.
For me, that's the main reason that I enjoy writing, is just discovering these surprises that pop out almost like I didn't write them myself.
Coming up, novelist Dan Shaun joins us to talk about his latest novel, Sleepwalk. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.